Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
It's the Real College Podcast. I'm Patrick Sharkey. Following the most recent gun-related tragedy in Orlando and a Democratic sit-in in Congress to prompt a vote on stricter gun laws, we at Real College Podcast thought it an appropriate time to take a deep dive into the world surrounding guns. Roughly one-third of Americans own firearms. 8% of that one-third own more than 10. And yet, a massive majority of that one-third are not using guns to harm other people nor themselves. You know, there are many Americans who simply collect guns. And what about those who participate in gun sports? On today's show, reporter Emily Allen talks to the president of a gun club, and she looks to get a further understanding of the sport of guns and its participating members.
You come across these targets in multiple different scenarios. It really is a fascinating and hyper-addictive sport. It's just a ton of fun.
Then later, producer Emily LePain explores the history of gun culture in the United States and whether guns play a role in keeping the government in check.
They see guns as somehow a defense against this threat of government. And I think that to me is the kind of political logic that the NRA and those people have, which is a kind of suspicion of the motives of government.
Reporter Hannah Weichel takes to the streets to get to the opinions of everyday Americans. And I talked to local comedian John Thomas to find out if there's room for humor surrounding guns. All of that and more on today's Real College Podcast.
Growing up near the busy city of Chicago, it was challenging at times for current medical student Jacob Bermudez to participate in firearm sports, something he has been a part of since childhood. Fortunately, Jacob remembers escaping Chicago for hunting trips with his dad. Years later, Jacob is still pursuing his love for firearms as the president of a firearm sports group on campus that currently competes in three gun events, which are somewhat different from just hunting with your dad.
You know, in a good hunting trip, you'll fire one shot. A good day at a three-gun match, you may fire 1,000 rounds.
The University Firearm Sports Club was formed a year ago by Jacob and another friend, as he recalled in an interview we had earlier this week. After attending a Minnesota three-gun event, the two medical students returned to campus and decided to create a place where students could further their love for firearm sports. In the beginning, the team was made of medical students, and there were only 3 to 4 people regularly competing. 1 year later, there's about 12 members from all sorts of different departments. When asked how the team got the word out that they were accepting members, Jacob says that they didn't have to do much.
They have hunted us down, actually. No pun intended.
As the team has grown, Jacob shares that one of their struggles is obtaining enough equipment, since firearm sports demand a lot of resources.
The basics that you need for any three-gun match are going to be your belt, which holds all of the ammunition that you might need for a particular stage or round. Your three firearms, which are a rifle, a shotgun, and a handgun. And then ear protection, eye protection, maybe some gloves, maybe some knee pads, personal protection equipment.
Luckily, Jacob says that the Minnesota firearm community has provided many different supporters to the team, including local companies, manufacturers, and professional shooters.
Minnesota as a state has a lot of manufacturers and companies that are involved in the firearm sports. And so these companies have a lot to do with sponsoring these events and putting them on. We've got, you know, two amazing coaches who are, you know, some of the best shooters in the nation as far as I'm concerned.
With all of this support, the University Firearm Sports Club is developing at a good rate. Jacob says that for the time being, the team mainly competes in three-gun events. But what does three-gun entail?
It involves the use of tactical rifle, tactical shotgun, and a handgun. Some stages involve one, two, or all three of the weapons, and you know, any other combination. And you can be addressing targets from 200 to even 300 yards out, all the way, you know, into 10 yards. And you come across these targets in multiple different scenarios. It really is a fascinating and hyper-addictive sport. It's just a ton of fun.
While Jacob says the team manages to have a lot of fun, he also says that they are focused on being safe overall and making sure that their team members are as knowledgeable as possible.
First and foremost, our largest priority is safety. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the amount of people that compete in these three-gun competitions, you know, hundreds of thousands of rounds are fired and, you know, no injuries. You never have an injury out there. It's because of the diligence, training, concentration, and discipline of the members who are shooting.
Jacob and the rest of the team's leadership, he says, are very careful about selecting team members. Over the course of their first year, they've been approached by many different people, all interested in competing with the team.
We take our, you know, prospective new members out to the range. We run through kind of the laws of shooting with them, mm-hmm. and you evaluate whether they have the personality, the type of intellect that is required to observe and obey those laws.
Jacob says that along with taking prospective members to the shooting range, he and other teammates have also taken people simply interested in learning more about firearms. He says that the team has received a lot of attention, especially in regards to recent shootings like the tragedy in Orlando.
A lot of people, sometimes when those types of things happen, you know, we want to place blame. I really feel like it is an opportunity to share this wealth, this resource that we have. I think the shooting sports are phenomenal, and we're part of the community just like anybody else. And if somebody takes offense to what we're doing, I want to know about it. You know, if somebody feels threatened by what we're doing, I'd love to know about it. But so far, all we've gotten are positive feedback, people that are interested, people that want to learn. And we get more requests to join than I could ever fill.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Allen.
Oh, and I got you by my side. Everything's all right. It's just when you're gone.
This is Hannah Weichel from Real College Podcast, bringing you this week's gun-themed question of the week. I went to the Jamboree Parade on Friday night in Columbia Heights and asked some parade goers how they would feel if their neighbor owned a gun.
And so my question is, how would you feel if you found out your next door neighbor owned a gun?
I wouldn't care less.
And why is that?
Because I'm not afraid of guns. And people are the ones operating the guns, not the gun doesn't operate itself, so.
And do you yourself own a gun?
Sure do.
I actually saw that before, and that was like back when I was in sixth grade, and I didn't say anything because I was scared. But now I will probably actually say something, like literally tell a cop or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you?
I wouldn't mind it. If he has it for self-defense, it's a reasonable understanding. I don't really mind it at all. If he does something with it, it's his decision, not ours. I mean, just be wise. If you have a gun and if you want to use it, just be wise about it. Don't do stuff that is not reasonable, or don't do things that you might regret later about it. That's all I have to say.
Okay. So the question is, how would you feel if you found out your neighbor owned a gun?
I mean, I guess it's not really an issue unless he brings it out into the public, or uses it in some way towards me.
Wouldn't bother me a bit.
And why is that?
No, this is not your son.
I dressed him.
Oh my God.
Okay. Do you yourself own a gun already?
Yes.
Okay. And has anybody ever questioned you about that or?
Nobody.
Okay.
I don't want him to own one of the, what are they, AK-47s or whatever they are. But if they want to, if they're a hunter or if they're a police officer or anything like that, I don't care if they have a gun. They have a right to it. I don't want them to have assault rifles.
Okay.
And
perfect.
I hate guns.
Oh, why is
by
that?
By the way. Oh, I would never allow a gun in my house. My son was never allowed to have toy guns. No, I don't like guns.
But you're okay with your next door neighbor having?
Yeah, they have their rights.
If he had a gun permit, you know, I would definitely be fine on the safer hand. At the same time, though, it all depends on their personality. If you, you know, if you get where I'm coming from. Honestly, there's a lot of crazy people out here that can get a gun permit easily, and those wouldn't be the right people to have a gun in their hand.
The question is, how would you feel if you found out your next door neighbor owned a gun?
Oh, I be completely fine with that. I wouldn't be sad about it.
No, I'd be fine with it too. I mean,
Gates would probably be happy about it.
Yeah, as long as they're, you know, as they're allowed to. You know, I mean, if they're, you know, if they can, if they're, you know, by law, if they're allowed to carry it, yeah. If they're allowed to have it, yeah, it's fine.
Not really safe. I'm not too fond of guns. I made the decision not to buy a gun, so I'm kind of against guns. So I wouldn't feel too safe. They may feel safe, but I don't feel that safe. So
okay. Even when it's your next door neighbor, not necessarily in your household?
Yeah. Not even in my household, but next door neighbor, yeah.
Have you ever had that experience that you know your next door neighbor or somebody in your neighborhood has a gun?
No, and I'm glad to not know if they had it. So yeah, no.
You wouldn't want to know?
No.
No?
No.
Guns. They've been in the news a lot since the Orlando shooting on June 12th. They've been in the news a lot in the last several years, really, as three of the deadliest shootings in the United States have occurred in the past 10 years. But knowing what qualifies as a mass shooting can be a little tricky because the United States government has never actually defined mass shooting as a standalone category. So depending on what informal definition you choose to go with, the number of mass shootings can vary drastically. According to the Gun Violence Archive, which collects data from shooting incidents, a mass shooting is defined as any incident where four or more people were wounded or killed. By that definition, a University of Alabama study found that 31% of all public mass shootings in the world occurred in the United States, despite the U.S. accounting for only 5% of the world's population. By that same definition, we saw 136 mass shootings within the first 164 days of 2016. Civilians in the United States own around 270 million guns, according to a 2007 report by the Switzerland-based Small Arms Survey. This makes the U.S. the number one country in firearms per capita. Americans are buying guns in record numbers, and if history is any indication, firearm sales will only increase in the wake of the Orlando shooting. According to the FBI National Instant Criminal Background Check System, the demand for guns skyrockets with more public debate on gun control. But why are guns such a huge part of American society? Bill O'Reilly was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert the day following the shooting, and this is what he had to say.
Hundreds of millions of guns on the streets of America right now, okay? Legal guns. And that's not going to change because we have the Second Amendment protections. And our history is one of that we use weapons not only to get our freedom from Great Britain, but to forge the West, and where there wasn't any control of the law.
O'Reilly might have a point. Guns played a large role in the founding of this country and settling in what were perceived to be unoccupied lands. But how does our history play into guns in America today? I talked to Thomas Wolfe, a history professor at the University of Minnesota, to find out.
I think it has to do with settler societies. So I think our relationship to guns has something to do with this idea of settling what it was perceived to be vast, empty spaces with small groups of hostile opponents. The idea that there was a sort of threat to the society that was being built by the former, you know, by the imperial power was taken up, and I think this idea that the colonists had recourse to guns for a couple of centuries, and it was their way of, you know, constructing security and autonomy.
But at some point, guns became less of a practical necessity.
I think the crucial transition was in the early part of the 20th century when we went from this idea that a kind of recourse to the practical need of guns, that people said, oh, but these are vitally useful, practical things, you know, both for security but also for hunting, you know, for those, you know, that handful of people that actually used it to get food. So this transition from a practical need to a kind of cultural need, that the guns enabled a kind of connection to their ancestors and to a past. So I think that's what took over. So I think, you know, the practical dimension has steadily fallen, whereas the cultural dimension has gotten more and more important.
But from where does this cultural need for firearms originate? Wolf thinks it stems from a negative response to the growth of American government.
You know, I think it's a reflection of the problems that Americans have had with the growth of government in the last century, I think. Certain parts of the country are much more suspicious of just this idea of government, and they see guns as somehow a defense against this threat of government. And I think that to me is the kind of political logic that the NRA and those people have, which is a kind of suspicion of the motives of government. Where again, you know, I think the vast majority of Americans don't even think twice about, well, of course, the government needs to pay attention to guns.
And due to this inherent suspicion, for many people, any form of gun control is seen as an infringement to their Second Amendment rights.
The thing we haven't mentioned is the connection to the Constitution and the idea of the rights. So gun ownership as being a right in the Constitution, I think, is incredibly important. So that they, by feeling a certain way about guns, they're also feeling a certain way about the Constitution. You know, I think it's the old slippery slope argument, isn't it? That as soon as you start to tamper with what is a gun, what's an acceptable gun, what's a sporting gun, what's a hunting gun, as soon as that discussion starts, they're going to, you know, you'll lose your right at some point.
And while some may still see gun rights as a means of protection against government tyranny, support for stricter gun control laws has increased 9 percentage points, up to 55% since the Orlando shooting, according to a recent CNN poll. On top of that, support for specific gun control laws has also increased. 92% of people support expanded background checks, while 85% support banning people on federal watch lists from buying guns.
I think for the vast majority of Americans, we have moved on from the centrality of guns in our lives. We look back in our history and we go, yeah, okay, it sort of made sense to have them in the 19th century or whatever, 18th, I mean, you know, whenever they were useful, I guess. But for most people, the vast majority of people, they're not useful. We have no feelings towards them except sort of unease and sometimes horror when this stuff takes place.
For the Real College Podcast, I'm Emily LePayne. For the Real College Podcast, I'm Jackie, here to bring you Word on the Street. On Monday, you can catch the Roe Family Singers at the 331 Club. This local band has been playing the 331 every Monday for the past 11 years, so if you haven't already seen them, you can seize the opportunity tomorrow. Our producer Hannah ran a great profile on the band that you can catch online in last week's episode. But for now, here's the song All I Need by the Roe Family Singers. On Wednesday, Lunch Duchess is throwing a tour kickoff show at the Turf Club. The lineup features a ton of cool local bands like Fury Things, Bruise Violet, Wretch, Bug Fix, and Mr. Princess. Lunch Duchess is the solo project of Catherine Segerman of Boyf, and she actually sings and drums at the same time, which is super awesome, and you can hear it here in this track. This is Cry from Lunch Duchess. Thank you. by popular demand, Jake Rude will be hosting another installment of a Prince-themed transmission on Saturday at First Avenue. All proceeds will be going to the Harvest Network of Schools. So, in honor of Prince, here's part of Let's Go Crazy. This life, also on Friday, local bands Fort Wilson Riot and Poor Nonono will be having a split EP release show at the 7th Street Entry. The lineup also features Aaron Rice and Holiday, who just released their debut album last April. So here's the 2014 Fort Wilson Riot single, Yes Indeed. That's it for Word on the Street. I'm Jackie Renzetti, and you're listening to the Real College Podcast.
To close the show this week, I'd like to play a short clip of an interview that I conducted with John Thomas, a local comedian who was voted 2015's Funniest Person in the Twin Cities by Acme Comedy Club. John hosted a fundraiser called Stand Up for Orlando the Thursday after the mass shooting and raised money directly for the victims of the violence. I sat down with John to talk about the event and to see if there's anything funny about guns.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've written some jokes about... Well, it's odd to say, like, written jokes about Orlando because I wouldn't say that. You know, it's not like the victims are the butt of any of my jokes. Obviously, I would never do anything like that. But one of my first, like, impulses was to write... I'm a cast member on a show called Boy Kisses, which is a weekly show over in Lynn Lake. And I did those jokes the night of, and I think that was a really cathartic experience. And I think I'm going to work on some of that. But yesterday was a night, I wanted everyone to have a good time, you know? I think that the way people have been impacted by this tragedy has been, it's been like nothing I've seen before. I guess I can't really remember how people were after 9/11 or even after Sandy Hook. I think it's just because this is, you know, it validates people's fears. And I think we're living in a climate that, as opposed to even a year ago, especially the older members of the LGBT community I'm friends with, have, I think, been worried about more violence. And then this happened.
You know, how did you kind of come up with the idea for the show? So it's called Stand Up for Orlando.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of threw this together pretty quickly.
Yeah, I was fortunate to, I have a monthly spot at Comedy Corner. I usually throw on a comedy trivia show, but it just didn't make sense this week. It made a lot more sense to me to use the slot for this. There's a really vibrant queer comics scene in the Twin Cities, and I think it's growing, and I think that, you know, anyone that's our age, it's like half of our friends are queer, you know? And I think that you see that reflected in the kids that we're getting at U of M Comedy Club. And I think that it was a responsibility to throw on an event like this, because we can't be like just queer and we happen to be comics, you know? That's not, when you are a part of a group that is like a minority group or something like that, you, part of what sucks about that is you have a responsibility to the other people that are in that group, you know? And I think that I see that personally, you know, being a queer person, and I see that in other sections of my life too. My goal last night was to put on a good comedy show that got people to donate money. I don't really look at last night as a vigil or a memorial for the victims, because there is so much of that that is going on right now, and that has been beautiful to see. And there's not everything has to be grief, you know? And so last night to me wasn't about grief, and it wasn't about memorializing even. It was about what can we do now to help these victims' families.
So, I mean, where is there humor to be found within guns? Or just, I mean, what's the relationship there?
So, first of all, and I don't mean to, like, give a boilerplate answer at all, but to just start off with, I'm not trying to like, patch Adams and be like, you can find beauty in anything. But I really think that everything is there's humor. I truly believe that. I have, there's been a lot of stages in my life where I've had people pass away or, you know, different periods of grief. And never to do with gun violence, but I think that part of the humor there is how scared we are and how strong of emotional reactions that we have, you know? But one thing that I think is becoming more frequent source of comedy that I think is being accessed more is the bewilderment at these issues. That disconnect, there's humor there too, you know? Just in finding out, like figuring out for yourself why you have the opinions you have and the conflicting ones that you have and your own hypocrisies, you know? I think seeing for yourself why your own opinions on these tragedies are imperfect, there's a lot of humor there too. And whenever something like this happens, there's that Onion article that's always shared, which is like, nation mourns, can't possibly believe that this tragedy happened again. And that's finding that space, you know, that hypocrisy, that where we're laughing at ourselves. We're not laughing at the victims. We're not like, it's not like some sort of robot chicken joke where just someone got shot in the balls and, or there's just some gruesome act and then we're laughing at how gruesome it is. We're laughing at our own, the ways we formulate our opinions. So I think there's a lot of space there. More than anything, I think there's space in laughing at ourselves and how we respond to these things.
That's all for this week's Real College Podcast. Emily LePain, Emily Allen, Jackie Renzetti, and Hannah Weichel all contributed to today's show. My thanks to them, in addition to John Thomas, for sitting down with me for a half hour. The entirety of my interview with John is available on our website, radiok.org. Real College Podcast is produced by Jackie Renzetti, Emily LePain, Max Fuller. Our managing editor is me, Patrick Sharkey. Real College Podcast airs every Sunday at 6 p.m., and you can always subscribe to our show in any podcatcher that you choose. Have a great week. Miracles I have not seen. From ancient autographs I cannot read. And though I've repented, I'm still tempted, I admit. But it's not what bearing witness.